What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Hey, listeners. This episode is part of our new playlist to help everybody get through these times we're living in. It's our Host Faves playlist.
Yep, these are just some of our personal favorites, ones that we had a particular affinity for, and because these are stressful and trying times, we tried to stick to the ones that weren't quite as dour.
So hopefully they'll give you a little lift. Stay safe. Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
Once you have read some of Edward Gorey's books, it is almost impossible to mistake his work for anyone else's unless maybe they are intentionally working in the style of Edward Gorey. His black and white pen and ink illustrations look almost like engravings. They're just full of hatching and cross-hatching. The words are lettered by hand, and the stories a lot of times unfold through either rhyming couplets or limericks or some other verse. The plots a lot of times end really ambiguously, or they never resolve at all. It's this gloomy, foreboding, typically Edwardian world that's populated by bats and cats and odd creatures and grown-ups who are usually in very glamorous clothing, and a lot of children who somehow come to harm. In one of his most well-known books, which is an alphabet book called The Gashlycrumb Tinies, M is for Maud, who was swept out to sea. N is for Neville, who died of ennui. The other tinies are assaulted by bears. They're sucked dry by leeches. They're run through with awls. It's all very darkly whimsical. So if you don't know much about Edward Gorey's life, you might imagine the person who did this to be a dour Englishman with the peak of his career, maybe sometime in the 1920s or 30s, whose own childhood was marked with a series of tragic deaths. But Edward Gorey was none of those things.
No, he's delightful.
He's who we're going to talk about today.
Edward Gorey, nicknamed Ted, was born Edward St. John Gorey on February 22nd, 1925, in Chicago, Illinois. He was the only child of Edward Leo Gorey and Helen Garvey, who divorced when he was 11. His father later remarried singer and guitarist Karina Mura, who was most well known for being the guitar player at Rick's Café Américain in the movie Casablanca.
Gory's parents remarried one another in 1952. Already it's kind of whimsical and kooky.
I know. The family had predominantly Irish roots, with ancestors on both sides immigrating to the United States in the mid to late 19th century. Although his father was Roman Catholic and his mother was Episcopalian, Gory himself wasn't particularly religious, and later on in his life he would say that if he was anything, he was a Taoist.
He was also quite precocious, and he started drawing before he was even 2 years old. His oldest surviving drawing, called the Sausage Train, is of the trains that passed by his grandparents' house in Chicago, and he drew that when he was about 18 months old. And this is full of oblong shapes that are recognizably trains, but they were also very definitely drawn by a small child, so it's not like he just whipped out realistic drawings and people went, Wunderkind!
No, it is startlingly adept for an 18-month-old, but still obviously a child's drawing. By three, Edward Gory had taught himself to read, and by five or six, sometimes he says he would say seven in interviews, it varied a little bit, he had read two books whose influence on his own work is really obvious, Alice in Wonderland and Dracula. So if you ever read an Edward Gory book and said, man, this is like if Alice in Wonderland had a baby with Dracula.
You were exactly right.
That was right.
And although Gory described his upbringing as very ordinary Midwestern childhood, in reality, he moved around a lot. By the time he left for college, he had had at least 12 different addresses, including staying with relatives in Florida for a brief stretch after his parents' divorce. He was overall a good student, and he was bright enough that he skipped first grade. But sometimes, after changing schools, his work would waver a little as he adjusted to a new environment.
By eighth grade, Gory was drawing illustrations for the school yearbook, as well as participating in typing club, art club, Shakespeare club, and glee club, along with serving as assembly president. He also, sometime in those years, learned to play the piano.
The most stable period of Gory's education before college was when he was at Chicago's Francis W. Parker School. He enrolled there in the ninth grade, and he graduated on June 5th, 1942. And while there, he was clearly interested in art, hanging out with a clique of other artistically inclined students, and participating in his first school art show in 1939. Reportedly, his senior yearbook had no photo of him, but a blank spot where he'd draw himself in when people asked.
Gory was offered several college scholarships when he graduated from high school, but World War II was underway by the time he got out of school, and he was drafted into the United States Army. He was only able to take a couple of classes at the Art Institute of Chicago before reporting for duty. From 1943 until after the end of the war, he served stateside as a clerk, spending most of those years at Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. This was a testing ground for biological and chemical weapons and their countermeasures.
Gory did not talk a whole lot about his World War II service, although when it did come up in interviews, he virtually always mentioned the Dugway Sheep incident, which took place much later. That was a 1968 incident in which thousands of sheep were killed in western Utah, purportedly by nerve agents from the facility. But it was while in the military that Gory started writing plays as a way to occupy his time.
After being discharged from the Army, Gory enrolled at Harvard, which was paid for by the GI Bill, where he majored not in art, but in French literature. Even though he wasn't majoring in art, he continued to both write and draw. He published poems and stories in the campus magazine Signature, as well as illustrating for the magazine and for other publications.
At Harvard, Gory became friends and, for a couple years, roommates with poet Frank O'Hara. They decked out their dorm suite with rented furniture, and they made it into their own little salon. Poet Donald Hall, another Harvard graduate, is quoted in Harvard Magazine as saying, quote, they gave the best parties. O'Hara was definitely the bigger partier of the two young men, though, so they eventually drifted apart a bit. And this would be an ongoing theme in Gory's life. He was charming and generous once you got close to him, but he often preferred to be more solitary than social.
Gory graduated from Harvard in 1950, and he stayed in Cambridge, Massachusetts for a couple of years after that, working in bookstores and helping to start the Poets Theater. The Poets Theater's founders and original members were all students or recent graduates from Harvard, including Alison Lurie, John Ashbery, and Donald Hall. They would stage their own and revival works of poetic drama. Even though he had been writing poems and since high school and plays since his time in the Army, a lot of Gorey's work with the Poets Theater was more as an artist and a designer for both the stage and the production's programs and promotional materials. You can still see like scans of old programs that he drew in these years immediately after he graduated.
Gorey stayed in Massachusetts for a couple of years, mainly working part-time in bookstores, before he made the move to New York City, and that marked a huge shift in his life and career, and we're going to talk about that more after we pause for a sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but, like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
While Edward Gorey liked his work with the Poets Theater, he wasn't able to support himself working part-time at Cambridge bookstores. In late 1952, he designed a couple of book covers as a freelancer for Barbara Zimmerman and Jason Epstein, who he knew from Harvard. Epstein soon offered him a job at the art department at Doubleday Anchor in New York City.
He started out doing paste-up and corrections of other people's work, and eventually started designing book covers. He was good at it, and he was efficient, which left him time to work on his own projects and to do additional work as a commercial illustrator. In his own work, he was primarily drawing in black and white because he knew from his day job that it would be hard to find a publisher for full-color illustrated books at the time. But the covers that he was drawing while at Anchor usually were in color, often with subtle, muted tones.
There are people who have written whole papers about Edward Gorey's use of color on the book covers he was drawing for publishers, especially since his own books are so often in black and white. Gorey's first book, which was The Unstrung Harp, or Mr. Earbrass Writes a Novel, came out in 1953. This is about a frustrated man trying to write a novel. It's the closest to an autobiographical work, probably of all of his work. The Listing Attic followed in 1954. Neither of these books sold particularly well, though. And later on, Gorey bought up copies that he found on remainder tables to give them as to friends as presents.
Soon after moving to New York, Gorey found one of his truly great loves, and that was the New York City Ballet, under the helm of its founder, George Balanchine. Gorey had been to the ballet before. He had gone as a child in Chicago. But after attending a few performances in the 1952-1953 season, he started attending more and more of Balanchine's productions until, starting in 1956, he was attending literally every performance.
This took dedication. Apart from the obvious that that is a lot of ballet to attend, at Christmas time it meant attending nearly 40 performances of The Nutcracker. I read an interview with him where the interviewer was like, please explain this to me. How are you able to sit through 39 performances of The Nutcracker?
Here's why I'm laughing so hard. I feel like should one day someone attempt to write a biography of me, they would be like, and she saw Star Wars 37 times in the theater. So I understand a little bit how you could go see The Nutcracker 40 times in a row.
Well, it was 40 times in a row for like years and years in a row. Like he did it every season. And then he saved all of his ticket stubs from all of these trips to the ballet. He loved the ballet so much that in 1970, he wrote The Lavender Leotard, or Going a Lot to the New York City Ballet. And this initially came out in Playbill as part of the celebration for the ballet's 50th anniversary. When The Lavender Leotard came out as its own standalone book, Edward Gorey hand-painted covers for its first-run edition because the printer had not been able to match the exact right shade of lavender. This is how dedicated he was to the New York City Ballet.
I love him so much. Gorey wrote one other book explicitly about ballet during his career, The Gilded Bat, which came out in 1966. But the influence of ballet is clear in his other works as well. The people he draws often have turned out toes, elongated, extended poses, and even when something terrible is happening to them, a sort of graceful presence on the page.
On nights when Gorey wasn't going to the New York City Ballet, he was often at the opera or the movies, and he became a very recognizable presence around New York City. He typically wore a full-length fur coat over jeans, a shirt, and Converse sneakers, and he wore a lot of very heavy jewelry, especially rings, a lot of which was made out of iron or brass. He was a very recognizable person.
So if you want to throw together a fun Halloween costume, go as Edward Gorey. It's a pretty easy one to put together, and it's kind of nerdy and cool. He also started accumulating the books that would eventually grow into his own personal library during this time. He loved to read, and he tended to come back home with a book anytime he left the house. A particular favorite was Agatha Christie, who he had been reading and rereading since childhood. He also loved Jane Austen, describing her as his idol. Another favorite was Anthony Trollope, although he did not revisit Trollope's work very much as he got older. He also loved poetry, particularly the work of W.H. Auden.
He did not love everything he read, though, and he was very candid about authors and actors and anyone else that he did not particularly like. So he made no secret of the fact that he despised nearly everything by Henry James. In spite of the fact that he had drawn the cover art for some of Henry James's books, there is a little sign in the Edward Gorey house today that says, please no Henry James in the Edward Gorey house.
I love it so much. Gorey's New York City apartment also became home to a number of cats, many of them named after characters in Murasaki Shikibu's 11th century Japanese novel, The Tale of Genji, another lifelong favorite work of literature.
Throughout this time in New York City, Gorey was writing and illustrating his own books. Even though most people remember him for his art, he really thought of himself as a writer first. With every line, he would think, can this make a drawing? But he didn't actually start illustrating until he was satisfied with the words. And he revised as he went. He would get one sentence exactly right before he moved on to the next one.
In 1957, Doubleday published Gorey's The Doubtful Guest, which carries a lot of the hallmarks of his later work. A peculiar guest who looks a little like a penguin shows up at a mansion inhabited by a family that looks somewhere between Victorian and Edwardian. Whatever it is, the guest is ill-mannered and weird, and it has been bothering the family for 17 years at the end of the book. The very strange The Object Lesson came out a year later.
I tried to figure out how to sum up The Object Lesson in a sentence. It's not really possible. It involves, like, some tongs and a prosthetic leg. It's very surreal. It's one of the things that people point to when they talk about surrealist influences on Edward Gorey. So in 1959, The Doubtful Guest caught the eye of Edmund Wilson. He wrote about it in an article called The Albums of Edward Gorey in the December issue of The New Yorker. This brought Edward Gorey a lot more attention than he had before, and it was the first time a lot of people had ever heard of him. Although at this point, he was creating so many book covers for Doubleday Anchor that they had almost certainly seen something he had drawn before.
1959 was also when Gorey left Doubleday Anchor to serve as art director at Looking Glass Library, which set out to repackage classic works for children. In addition to being the art director, he helped select some of the 28 books that were ultimately published, and he did illustrations for a few of them. The most famous was his illustrated War of the Worlds, which came out in 1960. He also illustrated a book of ghost stories called The Haunted Looking Glass, and he also chose the stories themselves for that one.
Looking Glass Library folded in 1962, and Gorey started doing some work for other publishers as well as working freelance, including designing advertisements. He also started granting permission for his existing illustrations to be used in other work. One example from later in his career is an end-of-life planning booklet called Before I Go, You Should Know, My Funeral and Final Plans, which was distributed by Funeral Consumers Alliance.
It sort of seems perfect for Edward Gorey to have agreed
to. It
does. Also in 1962, the much beloved The Gashly Crumb Tinies debuted as part of a three-volume work called The Vinegar Works, Three Volumes of Moral Instruction, which also included The Insect God and The West Wing. The Gashly Crumb Tinies has never been out of print.
That same year, 1962 was a big year, Edward Gorey and Francis Steloff launched the Fantod Press. Steloff was founder of the Gotham Bookmart, which was a bookstore and literary haven that had become the primary distribution point for a lot of Gorey's work. Gotham Bookmart is where Gorey sat to hand paint all those copies of The Lavender Leotard, and when it opened an art gallery in 1967, he was one of its first exhibitors.
Gorey and Steloff launched Fantod Press together because Gorey had trouble finding a publisher for a lot of what he had written, and he wanted a way to publish it himself. The press's first book was The Beastly Baby, which was the first work Gorey had ever tried to publish. It was one of the many books that came out under a pseudonym that was an anagram or near anagram of Gorey's own name. In this case, Ogdrid Weary. The Beastly Baby features a big, sticky, shrieking, gurgling baby that does horrible things like burn the upholstery with acid. According to Gorey, it made people so angry that mothers tore it up and mailed the pieces back to him. I have always contended that seeing this book as a kid is one of the reasons I never wanted children.
In the late 1960s, Gorey started spending more time on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, transporting his cats with him back and forth between there and New York City. He was always in New York during ballet season, but eventually he would move out to the Cape permanently. We are going to talk about that after another quick sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but, like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered. Could just be
in
me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Edward Gorey had relatives who lived on Cape Cod, so he had visited there from time to time over the years. As he started to spend more time there in the 60s and 70s, he got involved in local theaters all along the Cape, designing promotional materials and costumes, staging work of his own, some of it quite experimental. He continued to do some of the same work in New York City as well.
In 1973, Gorey designed the set for a production of Dracula that was to be staged on Nantucket off the coast of Cape Cod. When he was drawing for books, Gorey usually worked at about the same size as the finished printed product. For this set, which looks like a black and white cross-hatched illustration from one of his books, he drew larger images that were then blown up for the stage.
This same staging opened on Broadway on October 20th, 1977, where it ran until January of 1980. It was nominated for 3 Tony Awards, one for the sets and the costumes, which Gorey had also designed, and it was also nominated for Best Revival. Gorey won the Tony for his costume work, and the production also won the Tony for Best Revival, but it always really bothered him that the sets had not won as well. They are quite striking.
It's one of those things that happens where you shrug, where it doesn't make sense. We see it all the time.
Apparently, it rankled him.
I can understand that. A musical adaptation of Gorey's own work, Gorey Stories, appeared on Broadway in 1978 after getting its start at the University of Kentucky. And Gorey adored this production, which had a brief run off Broadway in January and February, along with 16 previews. It officially opened on Broadway on October 30th, and it closed the very same night. The New York Times and Daily News had been on strike for months, and it just had not gotten much publicity.
There are, of course, other stagings of Gorey's work or plays he was related with, but Dracula on Broadway and Gorey Stories are the two Broadway productions. Gorey spent more and more time on Cape Cod in the late 1970s and early 1980s. He started easing up on his patronage of the New York City Ballet as George Balanchine started passing some of his leadership onto his successors. When Balanchine died in 1983, Gorey decided it was time to think about leaving New York entirely.
At first, he moved to Barnstable, Massachusetts, where he stayed in a house belonging to relatives. Then he moved into a 200-year-old sea captain's home in Yarmouth Port that he'd bought with his Dracula royalties, and he nicknamed it the Elephant House.
The Elephant House became home to Gorey, his cats, and his collections for the rest of his life. In terms of cats, he typically had 5 or 6. He thought 6 cats were a lot harder to keep up with than 5, and 7 was far too many.
this is exactly my numbers. 6 is where I'm maxed out. 5 is kind of perfect.
Yeah, he had a whole thing about when there are 6 cats, they somehow form this phalanx of cat. And then 5 is like not having so much of a supernatural level of combined cat intelligence, but 7 is right out.
In my experience, this is all entirely accurate. And for collections, moving from a tiny New York apartment to an entire house meant that he could spend his weekends poking around yard sales and looking for treasures. And he collected all kinds of things. There were, of course, books, of which he had approximately 25,000 by the end of his life, but also cheese graters, salt and pepper shakers, knickknacks, interesting rocks, toys, games, art, including some terrifically bad art, on and on. He was often inspired by the Japanese concept of wabi-sabi, which ties to beauty found in the simple, the impermanent, and the mundane.
His time on Cape Cod really contributed to the perception that Edward Gorey was a recluse. In New York City, he had gone out almost every night, especially when the ballet was performing, always wearing this very recognizable fur coat and jewelry. But after he moved into the Elephant House, he stayed home a lot more. In addition to working, he read a vast number of books, and he also watched a whole lot of TV. He spoke often for his love of things like Doctor Who, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and daytime soap operas. Gorey's work is also on TV. In 1980, he worked with Derek Lamb to animate the Introduction to Mystery from Boston Public Television, which for some people was their first introduction to Edward Gorey's work.
Often, while he was watching all this television, he'd make little beanbag creatures filled with rice, recognizable animals like bats, frogs, and elephants, as well as characters like Figbash, a long-armed creature from The Raging Tide or The Black Doll's Imbroglio, who would later also have his own alphabet book.
Some of this perception that Edward Gorey was reclusive came from interviews as well. He could be quite charming and gregarious in interviews, but really only if the interviewer was asking him interesting questions. If you sat down with Edward Gorey with a list of boring, predictable, obvious questions, you might get a bunch of one-word or evasive answers in response, especially if other interviewers before you had already asked those same boring, predictable, obvious things. So if you walked into an interview with Edward Gorey and you ask him, "Why do you like to draw such macabre pictures?" when he had been asked that question and also hated being called macabre in the first place, you might get the impression he didn't like talking to people.
To add to all this solitude and curmudgeonliness, Gorey always lived alone and he never had a serious romantic relationship. Combined with an often campy way of speaking and presenting himself, this led people naturally to wonder about his sexual orientation. In a 1980 interview with Boston Magazine, Lisa Solod asked him what his sexual preferences were, and he answered, quote, "Well, I'm neither one thing nor the other, particularly." Later in that same interview, she asked, "Is the sexlessness of your books a product of your asexuality?" And he answered, "I would say so, although every now and then someone will say my books are seething with repressed sexuality."
These ideas came up in other interviews as well. For example, in 1984, he told Richard Dyer of Boston Globe magazine, quote, "Sometimes I ask myself why I never ended up with somebody for the rest of my life. And then I realized that obviously I didn't want to or I would have."
So it's definitely true that Gorey led a solitary life, particularly once he moved to Cape Cod. And he tended not to answer the door, the phone, or the mail, although that led to him feeling guilty about unopened piles of fan mail, which he once called, "thank you for being you, crap." He didn't like to be flattered or fussed over or bothered. He didn't want to talk about interpretations of his work because he liked the idea of people's imaginations having their own possibilities.
I'm just putting it out there. I will read "thank you for being you, crap" any day of the week. At the same time, though, it is really not accurate to think of Edward Gorey as a hermit or a recluse. He gave most of those little beanbag creatures that he made away to his friends. Even as he developed a cult fan following, he was listed in the phone book, and he was generous with his time when fans ran into him out in public.
If he literally knocked on the door, he might not answer it. But if he did answer it, expecting it to be someone he knew, he would talk to you. He ate out almost every day, with Jack's Outback restaurant being a particular favorite. He did a lot of work that required him to be social, particularly working with community theaters all up and down Cape Cod, staging plays and working on sets and costumes.
Edward Gorey wrote and published books continually from 1953 all the way to the end of his life. He created more than 100 books of his own and also designed the covers for hundreds of others, as well as handling the design and typography for at least 100 more. His illustrations accompanied the writings of T.S. Eliot, John Updike, Lewis Carroll, Virginia Woolf, H.G. Wells, Bram Stoker, and Gilbert and Sullivan, among others.
My introduction to T.S. Eliot was actually an edition of Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats,
yep,
illustrated by Edward Gorey, which Edward Gorey's cats are a lot friendlier and goofier than maybe anything else that he drew. Like, they often have these big, doofy smiles on their faces, and they look really loungy and cuddly. And so I got this impression that T.S. Eliot was like a
little snug bug.
Yeah. And then I got to college and I had to read The Wasteland and I was like, what is this?
Where are the kitties?
I still have that book. So because Gorey's original books are illustrated and they often feature children as characters, and because about 20 of these original books are alphabet books, sometimes people think of him as a children's author. And because terrible things often are happening to these children in the books, he's also often imagined to have hated children. But really, in his adult life, he didn't know any children. He didn't have any antipathy for them at all. At every time this came up in an interview, he consistently would be like, no, I don't actually know any kids.
While many of his books were suitable for most ages, others had a decidedly adult twist. For example, he illustrated The Recently Deflowered Girl, The Right Thing to Say on Every Dubious Occasion, published under the pseudonym of Miss Hyacinth Phipps. It's a faux advice manual written by Mel Juffy for what ladies should say after being deflowered in a variety of odd and sometimes awful situations. Gorey also wrote and illustrated The Curious Sofa, a pornographic work by Ogred Weary, which contains no nudity or explicit language, but also points the imagination in a very particular direction.
Today, many but not all of Gorey's books are available in collections with names like Amphigory and Amphigory 2. The first of these came out in 1972. Although Gorey himself preferred his books as they were originally printed and bound, today a lot of them are out of print outside of these collections. You can definitely find a lot of standalone books too, but there are things that are in those collections that it's hard to find in any other way.
Gorey died on April 15th, 2000, at the age of 75, following a heart attack that he had had a few days before. He was cremated, with part of his ashes sent to be buried with his family, part floated out to sea on a raft made of branches from the magnolia tree that grows outside of Elephant House, and a small part saved to be scattered in the yard where the cats were to be buried after the last of their deaths.
He left most of his estate to the Edward Gorey Charitable Trust, which funds animal welfare organizations. Edward Gorey was actually really interested in animal welfare, particularly cats and bats and in general, the welfare of animals. He actually gave up wearing all those famous fur coats as he became more interested in animal welfare later on in his life. When a family of raccoons invaded the Elephant House, he let them keep living there, almost as penance for having worn a raccoon coat for so long. By the time he died, he had amassed a collection of 21 fur coats, which the foundation started off selling at a rate of one per year and then sold the rest at auction in 2010 as a fundraiser.
In 2002, the Highland Street Foundation purchased the Edward Gorey home, and today it is the Edward Gorey House Museum, which is open seasonally.
Edward Gorey's influence continued to grow in the last decades of his life and after his death. In a 2011 article in the New York Times, Daniel Handler, the author of A Series of Unfortunate Events, which is published under the name Lemony Snicket, said, quote, "When I was first writing A Series of Unfortunate Events, I was wandering around everywhere saying, I am a complete ripoff of Edward Gorey. And everyone said, who's that? Now everyone says, that's right. You are a complete ripoff of Edward Gorey. That delights me. Daniel Handler dragging himself cracks me up a little bit. The first volume of that series of books came out the year before Edward Gorey's death. Neil Gaiman had actually said that he wanted Edward Gorey to illustrate his book Coraline, but Gorey died the day that Gaiman finished writing it. I don't actually know if Tim Burton has ever specifically cited Edward Gorey as an influence, but a lot of people writing about Tim Burton make that connection.
Well, the style is very similar of his drawings, yeah, for sure. So whether he said it or not, I think you can't discount it. Like, there's a very valid connection there. Tracy included this quote in her outline to end with. Quote, for some reason, my mission in life is to make everybody as uneasy as possible. I think we should all be as uneasy as possible, because that's what the world is like. And that was Edward Gorey is quoted by Richard Dyer in Boston Globe magazine in 1984.
We'll also put a link in our show notes just for fun from the great, sadly no longer actively in production website, The Toast, called How to Tell If You're in an Edward Gorey Book, which is delightful. That is Edward Gorey. Thank you so much for joining us today for this classic. If you have heard any kind of email address or maybe a Facebook URL during the course of the episode, that might be obsolete. It might be doubly obsolete because we have changed our email address again. You can now reach us at historypodcast@iheartradio.com, and we're all over social media at Missed in History. And you can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit nfl.com/schedule-release to learn more.
Tired of restless nights? At Leesa, we know good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. From memory foam mattresses to hybrids that keep you cool all night long, Leesa's mattresses offer exceptional comfort and support with free delivery and 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to leesa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. Exclusions apply. See leesa.com for more details.